You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Can everyone hear me now? Wonderful. So our next session here at Rebel Rouser is A World Without Racism. We're joined by longtime activist Joshua Virasamy to discuss how we can organise our activism around anti-racist principles. And his book, A World Without Racism, is available in the G Bookstore. So if you want to give a great big welcome now to Joshua.
Hey, can everybody hear me okay? Great. Up a bit or good volume? Okay, cool. So we've got first of all, thank you for coming and joining me and coming to this stage. The weather is typically very British, but it's really lovely to see you all here. We've got an hour. I've been invited to talk a bit about my book, which is titled A World Without Racism. It's an edited collection. It's got 10 different groups who all fight on different front lines, struggle on different issues across the country, and take an anti-racist position led by racialized people. They have anti-racist strategies and principles. And so this is the book. I'm going to read from it a bit. The way I was thinking we could do this is like, I don't want to speak for an hour because I would honestly put myself to sleep if I spoke for an hour. So I'm going to do like a bit of reading. And then I'm thinking we could do a healthy bit of Q&A. And one way we could do Q&A is a thing called fishbowl. Is anybody familiar with the fishbowl? Yeah, no, you can just move your head. Great, cool. So a fishbowl is like, it's a conversation table surrounded by an outer circle. And what we'll do is, after I've done some reading, we can come into like a bit of an interactive circle. We'll have a conversation table because I'm kind of hoping that through what I say, some feelings and thoughts will get moving within you. And then you can bring your questions to the table and it's an open table. People can come in and out and have conversations and we'll be able to have a bit more of a fruitful discussion. So my name is Joshua Virasamy. I work for the London Renters Union, which is a really radical, dope tenants union in London. We're almost 10,000 members. Been going for 5-6 years. I'm an activist. Been an activist for 14 years. Yeah, it's been a while. I'm very tired. I'm also extra tired because I have a baby. And I was up at 3 a.m. until I can't even remember. So bear with me a bit. I've been involved in lots of different campaign groups and movements, the Occupy movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, climate organizations, like an organization called Wretched of the Earth, which was like a climate justice organization. I'm involved in housing struggle now. So I've been organizing across quite a few different issues. So I'm going to do some readings, get into the subject a bit. I'm going to like read from the book, but I've also prepared some additional notes for this session, which I'll be reading from my phone, because a lot has happened since I published the book. I published the book on the 20th of July, and 10 days later, there was race riots across the country. So I feel like it's important to address that a bit. So I'll go through those things, and then we'll have an opportunity to do some Q&A. Does that sound okay? A few months ago, Marion, a resident in Hackney in East London, where one of our local tenant union branches organises, called me up, desperately explaining her housing issues. Marion had been forced into costly temporary accommodation, and I mean costly because many local authorities are going bankrupt, paying through the nose to private companies for temporary accommodation for people who are homeless because we don't have social housing. I need to stop doing this. I just ad-libbed loads off the book. And if I do that, I'm going to run out of time. Sorry. Prohibited from having visits and unable to move her sick mother from the top floor due to faulty lifts. And she was sharing facilities communally with dozens of other families. A prisoner is how she described her experience to me on the phone. Tens of thousands of recently arrived migrants to Britain are routinely placed in private temporary accommodation, in rooms sometimes separated by sheets, given food so inadequate that mothers are malnourished and are unable to breastfeed, where roofs fall in on playing children and regular outbreaks of diseases plunge hundreds into ill health. On occasion, these inhumane facilities are placed under strict curfew because of arson attacks by racist vigilante mobs. Fast forward a few weeks later, when running a training session with some of our members, using the Haitian Revolution as a case study for like self-organized political struggle, a member from our West London branch, again, a black migrant woman, told the group, "We're still just slaves. It's only different masters." To many immigrants navigating life on this small post-imperial island, a racially inflected, authoritarian nationalism carries with it all the feelings and registers to her and to others of a slave-owning time long gone by. In Britain, where both Labour and Conservatives trade on unanimous adoptions of a nationalist resentment, where it's always British this for British that, it feels to me that rebuilding a revitalized anti-racism, one which can form the basis of a unified international working class, is a matter of life or death. And I wanted to pause here and offer some kind of reflections that I didn't have the opportunity to do in the book before I come back to it. What are we talking about when we say racism? And why is it more relevant today than ever? History doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes, wrote Mark Twain. If you ask anti-racists of the 70s and 80s pedigree, they'll tell you what we've just seen, that is the mass racist violence sweeping across this country, can be traced on a line directly back to the National Front, or NF. The same NF that would pull a kitchen knife on my dad on his way to school, but they would also point out, this is in many ways entirely different. It is a product of this moment, and it is empowered for the first time by parliamentary representation, not just from the right of the Tories, but to the 5 insurgent reform MPs. 5. It is more virulent. It is more established. It is gripping power from Hungary to India to America, and consequently, it is far more dangerous. I'm sure it's familiar to most here, what just happened, but I actually think it's worth recalling, because I don't know about you, but I feel a bit gaslit. I feel like, what the hell? Did we not just have race riots across the country and we're all going back to work, and it's suddenly like, you know, people don't want to talk about it. It's uncomfortable, but I think we need to sit with what just happened. We haven't had an opportunity to really sit with what just happened. So I'm going to recall it a little bit. 3 weeks ago, across this country, and I mean across this country, from the 30th of July to the 5th of August, far-right, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, violence and mass protest swept across the country, chanting, slicing, burning, battering its way across the land. For 6 days, black and brown people listened to the loud, condemning chant, "You're not English anymore." If immigration deportation had a chorus, it would surely be this. Disorganized racists and fascist agitators mobilized thousands to the streets, millions more online, to terrorize Muslim communities, to beat people in the street. We've seen the videos, but there's also some we haven't seen. Black men being beaten, Muslim women being beaten, hijabs being dragged off whilst they're carrying their babies, temporary checkpoints at traffic lights. Brown taxi drivers pulled out of the driver door and beaten, checkpoints on street corners. Hundreds descending, pitchforks raised, hotel to hotel to hotel, because it was 3 hotels, by the way, Sheffield to Aldershot, to terrorize people seeking asylum in Britain, to set alight the building they've been forced into. When I spoke about temporary accommodation, that is these buildings. You know, with the separated sheets and the malnourishment, right? Burned to death. That was the intention, to burn them to death, parents and children alike. And the only word sufficient to describe this kind of racially motivated attempted mass murder is a pogrom. Mosques were pelted with projectiles for hours. Muslim families were barricaded in their homes. Mothers were having panic attacks. And the only word sufficient to describe that is terrorism. And it's no longer an isolated incident, right? When I wrote it in the book, when I was alluding to the arson attacks in Knowsley, you know, we might have imagined it was isolated incidents, but it wasn't. It was in Hull, Sunderland, Hartlepool, Darlington, Rotherham, Liverpool, Aldershot, Leeds, Middlesbrough, Lancaster, Weymouth, Solihull, Tamworth, Belfast, Bristol, Bolton, Stoke, Doncaster, Manchester. It was across the country. In these cities and towns, racism, you can think of it however you want, soft, hard, racism triumphed. Championed, in fact, by the most powerful people in the world, like Elon Musk, who is the most powerful person in the world, the richest man in the world, was retweeting the hashtags and slogans of these riots. And it was apologized for, right, by mainstream pundits and politicians of this land. And I was out in the riots of 2011. I'll be real, I was out, right? We weren't apologized for by mainstream politicians and pundits. No, we were handed down, you know, I'll come to it, but we were handed down over 1,800 hours of prison time at that time. You know, I'm not going to play that again, but if you compare it to what's happening now, it's just incomparable, what the criminalization of that time. And who better to swoop in predictably, and claim to be the defeater of this rot in our society than top cop himself, Sir Keir Starmer. The man who once raced to bang up as many black and brown kids in overnight kangaroo courts as he could during the riots of 2011, when, by the way, he was the director of public prosecutions. As I said, 1,800 years of prison time he doled out, many of whom just working class kids. For crimes of racist violence? No. For stealing crisps, bags of rice, bottles of water, and TVs. We'd be making a dangerous mistake to think this was some kind of spontaneous explosion of racism attached to mobs, as they like to call them on TV. Mobs, you know, like thoughtless thugs. To think it was a crisis of misinformation, that it was just, you know, social media, it's Twitter. To attribute it to the mega followings of people like Andrew Tate, to call this a rot even is a mistake. To cast our eye on it as if it is a far to the right is a dangerous misdiagnosis. What we saw was the tip of an iceberg. An iceberg built by the political and economic mainstream. Built by politicians and media barons. By billionaires who super exploit migrant labor, fruit pickers, delivery drivers. We saw a hyper-violent tip, but everywhere you turn, you see the specific kind of violence being meted out. Who took the train from London to get here today or yesterday? If you were on that train, I see a few of you. If you're on that train, you would have passed three stops. Luton, Bedford, and Wellingborough. Just to kind of pause for a second to be like, this violence is every day, by the way, right? Luton, one of the most deprived areas in the country, the home of the EDL, right? Where a lot of this, you know, the prototype of a lot of this fascistic violence we're talking about, Luton. Bedford, Yarlswood Immigration Detention Center. Does anybody know about Yarlswood? One of the most horrific detention centers. And many of us were going down to protest the conditions there, with people inside waving flags and phoning us at the protest to talk about how horrific the conditions are at Yarlswood. Owned, by the way, by Serco, which runs prisons. And on prisons, Wellingborough. A private super prison, a mega prison, recently built. Over 1,800 people, and it's owned by G4S. It's a profitable system. And Britain, by the way, you know, who fills these prisons? Britain has a higher disproportionality of black people in prison than the USA. Don't get it twisted. It is bad here. That's just three, you know, just taking the train, just looking around. This is the everyday reality, right? Sorry, when I speak loud, my mouth goes dry, so I've got to... What will we tell our grandkids about these riots? Or our kids about these race riots? That we overcame them with a big kumbaya, with some big metropolitan anti-racist mobilizations, which were great. Or will we tell them how it in fact continued after then, but in Parliament? Because a few days ago, Labour's Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, pledged in response to what was only just spray painted by rioters weeks before, to send them home. She said, "I'm going to send them home." She said, "I saw your spray painting. Go home." She said, "Yeah, I'm going to send them home. Don't worry about that." Mass deportation flights is what she's promised. More than ever. Two new immigration removal centres. You know the ones I just spoke about in Yarlswood? Two more of them. Right? Where inmates routinely commit suicide from the horrendous conditions there. I've been to an immigration removal centre not far from where I grew up in Hounslow, attached to Heathrow Airport. I've been there. I can tell you. I've spoken to people there. I can tell you. And I've been to war zones. And I can tell you, I have never seen such depths of despair when you're stuck in these places. Racism, what I'm trying to say, is top down. And as this edited collection argues, it is the natural consequence of an economic system that is predicated on, by that I mean made all the more profitable by, racialized division. It is urgent that we weed out systemic racism, but any good gardener knows that to deal with weeds, you need to know what the roots are, and you need to know what kind of tools you're going to bring. And I think it's worth taking 5 minutes. I'm going to take my watch off because I'm really bad with time. Taking 5 minutes to kind of remind ourselves of what we mean when we say systemic racism. Geographer and activist, pardon me, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, who's a really brilliant writer and written a lot about prisons and the economy of prisons, describes racism as, and we're going to get a bit technical, slightly academic here, but I think it's useful because we just had a lot of racist violence on the street. She describes racism as group differentiated vulnerability to premature death. Groups of people differentiated, divided off, and made vulnerable to premature death. And when we say vulnerable, what does that look like? When we say diminished life expectancy or life outcomes, what do we mean? We mean precisely overcrowded and unsafe housing, understaffed schools with high exclusion rates, deadly pollution, low paid and unsafe work, food deserts in urban areas, poverty. Across every issue that I've named, two things are true. Someone, somewhere, is turning a profit from these conditions. You know, like, why use safe cladding when you can use cheap, flammable cladding? And two, second thing that's true, is that racialized groups are disproportionately represented within every one of these outcomes. It was immigrant families like mine that filled tower blocks in West London, housed next to sewage facilities as we were, over-policed, overcrowded, irresponsible use of materials is most often and disproportionately represented by immigrant communities. And so we must fight racism there. That's what this book is talking about. This book is about racism, but it's about all these issues. It's about people fighting on all these issues. We have to fight racism wherever it rears its head. That's why this book has 10 issues with 10 groups led by racialized people. I think that music is quite loud and it's quite hypnotic. I think it would be good to kind of zoom in on this idea of differentiation. Because when I first heard the term, I was like, differentiation? What the hell does that mean? But before we zoom into differentiation, I'm going to zoom out. What makes the human world go round? Genuine question. What makes the world go round? Shout out, anybody? Money. Anything else? Power. Anything else? I was so sure somebody was going to say like a scientific thing like the sun and gravity and stuff. I'd argue money does make the world go round, but I'd argue if we go a bit deeper, that love makes the world go round. That love drives us. I'd argue that we make meaning out of life together through radical communion with all living beings, that we produce this most primary of human activities, producing to meet our own, but mostly to meet our collective needs. We sing, laugh, cook, and it's all the more sweeter when done with those we love. We find personal dignity, one of the most important things in life, through mutual respect. We have families that are made real through love, blood or not, and they become the most precious things in our lives. Love is cooperation, it is solidarity, it is the intimate knowing that, as the African philosophy Ubuntu explains, I am because we are. Buddhists call it interdependence. And this, for me, precedes everything. It makes all things possible. Love. But it's not profitable. It's not profitable. Division, then. And specifically, the creation and exploitation of difference is the opposite of love. That guy's got bars. That which separates us from one another, from nature, and which evidently creates the conditions for hatred, apathy, neglect, and breakdown. We have endured over 400 years of a social, economic, and political system that is built upon the absence of love. In fact, I'd argue that capitalism is a system built on the idea of radical separation for the pursuit of self, of individual power, of personal gain, of control, monetarily, politically, or otherwise. The pursuit of division is nothing new. Long before Machiavelli recognized the political expediency of what the ancient Greeks would term, I don't know how to say things in Italian, divide e impera, divide and conquer, humans have always had novel ways of differentiating ourselves. It is a bit of an Achilles heel. Social and cultural norms brought out systems of domination predicated on social constructs around differentiation. That's old. We can therefore say that patriarchal and racial systems existed long before capitalism. Slavs, as in from the Slavic nations, were enslaved on the basis of their culture and appearance. This is before capitalism. And you can note the etymological origins of Slavs and slaves. It goes back a long way. But what capitalism did, this genius system, as a revolutionary world system that transformed the cellular structures of life, landscape, oceans, home, governance, family, the very idea of work, everything, was to take these forms of differentiation that existed before it. In feudal systems, in other systems, it took these forms and said, I'm going to weave it into a new system, into the fabric of a market-based society, and make it profitable. Find ways to get value, to scrape value and profit from differentiation. And that's new, because when you want to do that, you'll find that you can do it everywhere you turn. The racial existed before capitalism, but racial capitalism was an entirely new beast. Capitalism, without gendered and racial differentiation, capitalism without differentiation has never been known. It's always existed, and it will always exist because it can scrape profit and value so effectively. It has literally cleaved worlds into existence. Three worlds, to be precise. With great genius, it has us thinking that three worlds is an entirely natural thing. We talk about the third world, or the global south, as a fact of nature, a fact of life. In secondary school, in geography, which I loved, we learned about the Brandt Line. Does anyone know about the Brandt Line? You learn about it in GCSE geography. It's this line that separates the global north to the global south, right? The rich and the poor. And we learn about it like it's an incident, like it's a kind of fact of the world. Rather than as a product of racialized differentiation and colonialism, of persevering total asymmetries of power. And racialized countries, because they are racialized countries, are known as poor countries. When we all know that what really differentiates them is where they are in the world and the fact that they are, as writer and activist Vijay Prashad calls them, the darker nations. They are nations that are plundered, kept down in an ongoing process that the really brilliant historian, Guyanese historian Walter Rodney called underdevelopment. And we talk about development. They were underdeveloped and they've been kept underdeveloped through lots of magical ways that the North, the global North, finds ways to, you know, keep the technology out, not allow them to use the same satellites, lots of different ways, trade agreements. I'm not going to riff because I run out of time. I just wanted to point out that, you know, one of the ways we need only look at how the West is treating Venezuela in this very moment. Venezuela that just had an election, like many other places that have elections, but the entire global North is condemning them and trying to remove a democratically elected president because, you know, it doesn't suit their interests. When we talk about racism, right, I'm trying to pull back and think about racism. When we talk about racism, we're talking about this persistent differentiation, which, you know, ascribes groups, you know, to the prison, to the immigration center, to the poor schools, to the food deserts, to the high-rise towers, differentiates, separates, puts them aside, makes them surplus. We're talking about a system that's best described as racial capitalism. We're talking about the novel ways that people are abandoned. Whole communities are abandoned. Sometimes called upon to be cheap labor to fill a prison. You know, when a new mega prison is built, people need to be filling it, right? To become super exploited labor, scapegoated, bundled in the dead of night into vans, deported, sent to immigration removal centers to score political points. And that kind of brings us back to this anti-immigrant xenophobia, which is at an all-time high. Do you know, question, do you know what percentage of the population thought immigration was a major issue in 1995? Want to guess? Anyone? What percentage of the population? 7? 11? 1, that's very low. It was 3%. 3% of people were animated by this issue. By 2015, this figure rose to 56%. How does a non-issue become an issue? Is it because ordinary British people were like coming out and counting the small boats? You know, blogging about it. I mean, some were, but you know, it wasn't a widespread thing. Do you think people were like monitoring the rates of immigration year to year? Some people were. It wasn't really happening. What happened between the 90s and 2010s was one guy. His name was Tony Blair. Under Blair, no policy area was legislated on more intensively than migration, right? His government focused on, and you know, I saw that Gordon Brown came to this festival before. You know, I'm talking about Gordon Brown, by the way, who came here. What did it result in, this period of like mass legislation on migration, which ended on, you know, coupling counter-terrorism legislation with migration legislation? That's how intensively they began to treat this issue. What did it result in? Dispersal zones. This is one of the most horrific policies, one of the most infamous policies under the Labour government, right? Send migrants to remote areas away from their own communities, often deprived areas where there is no hope to flourish and no hope of integration. It's a really sick and twisted policy. Under Blair, the introduction of deportation became a widespread deterrent. That was under Blair that it came into practice like that. And under Blair, the figure of the asylum seeker, right? Because in 1995 and in the late 90s, like, it wasn't a thing. People weren't as angry about asylum seekers as they were now, as they are now. Under Blair, the asylum seeker became the folk devil, the place to point the finger. And that hysteria rose and rose. You know when people share those graphics of like all the Daily Mail headlines and the, you know, that image of all the headlines all together? That was then. That was the early to mid-2000s. And by 2001, that environment was so hostile, long before Theresa May, you know, called it a hostile environment. She probably looked at that time, you know, the Tories looked to Labour for modelling. In 2001, it was hostile enough that three Kurds were attacked on an estate in Glasgow, including Fursat Dagh, who was stabbed to death as migrant children were being followed by gangs to and from school. The voice of politicians is indistinguishable from the tabloid press and indistinguishable from the far right. So, what can anti-racists do? And I'm going to return to the book. Sorry, I should have said this is not going to be like a jolly talk. It's not a jolly issue. But it's a bit more hopeful. If you buy the book, it's hopeful. It's a hopeful book. This collection consists of 10 chapters written by 10 different groups at the forefront of anti-racist organizing in Britain. Within the book, you will encounter activists resisting immigration regimes, waging a new era of feminist struggle, reimagining healing and health, resisting the expansion of the police state, which under Keir Starmer will be expanding very rapidly, organizing for access to food and land, fighting British imperialism through internationalism, and we haven't even spoken about Palestine, and fighting for climate justice and for a just and emancipatory education system, for empowering cultural expression, and for safe, secure, and dignified housing. There's a lot of issues that this book traverses. If race, as Stuart Hall, cultural theorist, wrote, is the modality, the way through which class is lived, these 10 chapters address the struggles through which class is felt and rebuked. Fighting racism today means fighting it at every corner it turns its head. If we are to deal with the historic specificity of race and racism, to theorize racial capitalism in this moment, we need to be in conversation with those currently undertaking this political struggle among the racialized poor and among the broader working class. And this collection is trying to do that. It's trying to be in conversation. And as a collection, this book has three primary motivations. One is creating an archive of this moment of anti-racist resistance from below, which I imagine will only be getting bigger. An archive that can facilitate ongoing learning in times to come. these projects are really important. We don't do them enough. I really encourage people to try and archive things happening around them. Not just for like, you know, because archives, we think of them as like dusty shelves. Archives are alive and they can be used in situ, in communities. You know, they're like a kind of toolbox. They're like a living library. Similar projects such as when members of the Brixton Black Women's Group got together to write Heart of the Race in 1985 have played a critical role in helping ensure that lessons are not lost. And instead they endure and they help us decipher this present crisis and how we find our way out. The second thing this book is trying to do, and this feels really important, and this is kind of like, you know, an important part of anti-racist strategy writ large, is trying to further our understanding of the ways in which our struggles meet and speak to one another. Where our strategies, our demands, our principles, and our opponents might align. Enough that we can confidently adopt campaigns, targets, strategies across movements. This is really, you know, it's minutes to midnight, and it's time for us to find ways to come together across struggle. This might be understood as the practice of popularizing our struggles, a proactive rather than reactive approach. As activist and educator Evia Day describes, we need to look at ways to cause conflict. And third, feels very important, especially as we look ahead to the next election where, let's be honest, nobody knows what the hell is about to happen, right? Tories are dead, Labour sinking, Reform are in the, what do you call it? Ascendance. The far right are winning across the world. The next election is an incredibly scary thought. The third thing is helping us take a big step forward in building a broad-based, anti-racist, feminist, anti-capitalist bloc capable of mobilizing millions in an effective counter-attack to the forms of mass dispossession and domination we're experiencing. I'm going to try and skip forward. In the 14 years I've engaged in political activism, I've had the honor of engaging with dozens upon dozens of local groups, institutions, national organizations, including most in this book. I've traveled from community halls to campuses, from Cardiff to Glasgow, working with climate groups, trade union delegates, and everyone in between. I've come to Greenbelt Festival. Whoop, whoop. I've spoken to tens of thousands and to a room of five, and it is plainly clear to me that the 10 groups in this collection are emblematic of something enormous, of a multitude of social forces, of thousands of groups, all resisting in some way or another, small or large, the wrath of racial capitalism. And this is our power. Who was at the Citizens UK session just before? That session was about that fact. How do we speak to people? How do we connect between organizations? How do we make this seemingly unnetworked social force align? The last time that this energy, connection, commitments, and social forces were leveraged almost all at once was rallying around the political force of man like Jeremy Corbyn. Yeah, big up Jeremy Corbyn. The question then, don't big up the Labour Party though, just Jeremy Corbyn. Who's left the Labour Party now? The question then, as it is now, is how do we build an alliance and synergy between the social and political forces? One which is owned by and accountable to the masses within the grassroots, right? All of us here and many more that we know. How do we build a confident, broad, counter-hegemonic bloc that is seeking to transform this moment? As Mohammed El Naim, one of the contributors in the roundtable on chapter 4, says, this is about making the politically impossible the politically inevitable. An important starting point in this endeavor is the recognition that capitalism, this thing I've spoken about as a totality, as a big, you know, seemingly immovable thing, is the recognition that capitalism actually always progresses in fits and starts. Capitalism is actually a lot of contingencies. It is a long history of ifs, buts, and maybes. And that therefore the preservation of its ruling class has never been and can never be a done deal. The impossible is always possible. It is, in that sense, always a matter of tilting the odds ever more in our favor. And what Citizens UK were saying in that session before is one of the ways you tilt the odds is by having conversations, by speaking to people. Tilting the odds is a strategic endeavor. It's about having all the things that I said about finding alignment, building the right alliance of forces and leveraging them effectively. Making the impossible possible was a long-standing interest of the late Chilean educator and public intellectual Mata Harnika. Mata Harnika is an incredible autodidact, self-taught, revolutionary Latin American, really important in loads of political struggles across that continent. And I really recommend looking her up. She's so inspiring. And she said, and maybe I'll end here actually. She said, politics cannot be limited to the art of what is possible. For progressives, politics must be the art of making the impossible possible. And that's not some kind of voluntary statement. She says, what I'm talking about is understanding politics as the art of constructing social and political forces that are capable of changing the balance of power and to benefit the popular movements, or what we might call here the social movements, and making possible in the future what today appears to be impossible. And I'll end it there. What time does this session finish? 4:15. How do people feel about doing a fishbowl? So like, we'll have like the person with the orange trousers. You see there's like 4 tree stumps next to you. Yeah. What we'll do is like, we'll have like a little mini table there, and you're very welcome to come and join that table. And everyone else, I would welcome you to kind of turn towards that table. You can move closer or you can stay where you are, but moving closer could be nice. And that table becomes a fishbowl. And that fishbowl, in that fishbowl, we're going to have a conversation. We're going to talk about how people feel about the race riots that just happened. We're going to talk about how people feel about the state of anti-racism. I want to hear questions that people might have. I imagine people have questions. We're going to bring it to that table. You can join the table, you can leave the table, you can walk up to the table and knock and say, I'd like to be on the table. And we're going to do that for about 15, 20 minutes. So does that sound good? Cool. So if you want to start on the table, come to the stumps over there in the middle. And if the rest of you can kind of come around, that'd be really cool. Yeah. Can people hear? Would a microphone be? The microphone's better. Yeah, cool. Who feels like they'd like to come and be part of a conversation? Please come. Yeah. We need 1 or 2 other people. It's just between us. Everyone else is just imagine they're not there. Brilliant. Thank you so much. You can stand or you can sit. Oh, these are quite heavy.
Should I sit on this one?
Yeah, great. Yeah, please. Great. Thank you so much for joining us. Did any of you have questions that you wanted to open up? If not, we'll take questions from outside.
I have a question. Maybe it's too detailed. Maybe it's too detailed, but it's about... It was quite surprising to me that growth was in under Blair. I mean, it may not be surprising to other people. Why do you think that was? Where did that come from? What was the driver?
What? Oh my God, that's quite wet.
Thank you. Because Blair was part of the colonial establishment. That's...
Yes. That's obvious in certain areas. I mean, it's obvious in the Middle East. But it wasn't like a plot. So what was the domestic driver is really my question.
Does anybody feel like they want to come in and try and address that question? The war in Iraq? Do you want to come back and elaborate?
Blair's a white man in this country, and I'm not describing, and I heard it talked about in a talk, I'm not describing whiteness as all white people. I'm saying it's a thing that we grow up with as a white person that means that we differentiate, which is what's just been talked about, and we create division, and that's what Blair did. Now, I know they did a lot of work around poverty and the child poverty stuff was there, and I understand that, and that was really important. But actually, that was one of the things that went very, very quickly after 2008. So it wasn't a commitment to poor people. It was, while we can, we'll do it, but we'll actually allow those people to fall as soon as the rich people get challenged. And that's what 2008 did.
I might jump off of the colonial, like Blair as a colonial figure and Labour, maybe like Labour as a colonial party. There's rarely like conspiracies, right? There's not, whether somebody sat in a room and said, spin the wheel, asylum seeker, I doubt. But it is true that some of the earliest xenophobic immigration acts, long before Blair, were under the Labour Party. Some of the Malay insurgency, the Kenya, the Mau Mau uprising, that was under the Labour Party. What I'm trying to suggest is that it's a tradition of the Labour Party to be xenophobic, to create folk devils and moral panics out of other communities. It's what Keir Starmer is doing in, you know, expanding the police state is just the tradition of the Labour Party. Blair, not to get too into the technicalities of it, but Blair, the Tony Blair Institute, is one of the major providers of staff for Keir Starmer's Labour Party. The Labour Party has a few hundred staff. Tony Blair Institute has 800 staff. And he's providing policy advisors. He is doing lots of policy direction. You know, he has a finger in a lot of... This is a continuity party. They don't really change the line very often. And they're xenophobic to the core. So I think it was a simple move for them. It was just... It's natural to them. What I can't square is like... I mean... Yeah, we don't need to get into it a lot, but under that Labour Party, immigration did, I'll use my words very carefully, grow. It did grow. It was an economic strategy. You know, it went from five figures to six figures very quickly, and it really went up, and they banked on migrants being able to provide the backbone of this economy, because, you know, just a point, the backbone of the British economy is migrant labour. So why they then chose the asylum seeker, to me, I'm like, I don't understand that. It doesn't seem, but you know, I don't have all the answers. But maybe that. Does anybody else want to come in on that? Or did you have a question, sir? Well, we can switch the question if you want to bring.
I just think that the Labour Party has moved to the right, and that no, it's no longer really a socialist party at all. It's trying to attract the popular vote ahead of, you know, following socialist principles.
Hey.
Do you think there might be an element of scapegoating for the financial situation we're in? So it's like, well, we need somebody to blame for the financial situation, so let's point the finger at somebody.
I was going to say something similar. I wonder if there's something about the politics of scarcity and the imagination of scarcity that shrinks the us. And so in times where scarcity is dominating our imagination, the circle of who the we is gets smaller, and there are more people outside that circle, and the kind of, you know, identifying those scapegoats beyond the us becomes more powerful as a political tool. It's a wondering.
I guess a point and then another question, if that's okay, to kind of segue. I guess I'd be keen to kind of get everyone's thoughts on like the kind of, I guess, like my real kind of concern or like drive at the moment is about like the kind of defunding and deprivation of like our kind of community spaces, our public infrastructure in which we can kind of organize to resist kind of state racism, state violence, and like while these spaces are kind of being stolen from us, defunded, like policing increased, the kind of attacks on like people's homes, like we saw that very visibly in like the arson attacks on hotels, but I guess we kind of see that on the day-to-day, and you see that in the day-to-day organizing like tenancies with like tenants, and the way like our homes are kind of very much under material attack at the same time as we're being deprived of spaces in which to come together. And a lot of people, particularly kind of asylum seekers, are criminalized to the point that it is often unsafe to kind of organize publicly. And so I'd be keen to kind of have a collective reflection on like resisting this violence like publicly without space, and also while, you know, like the most targeted and marginalized among us like are increasingly deprived of the public realm, I guess, entirely. And that feels like a big and scary question that I would be keen to. Yeah. I don't know if anyone has thoughts.
I love the fact that you talked about love making the world go round. And I know it's hard, because the fear that you can feel as a result of what's happened is really, for me, is really palpable. Because I live in Knowsley. I was there at the hotel. I remember doing counter-protests in the 80s. I can't quite believe we're doing it again. And it makes me very sad. But actually, the real strength of what's happening is people are coming together. That's happened in Liverpool, and I've been part of stuff since long time, even before what happened in Knowsley recently. But there's a strong group of people that are coming together, and there has been a strong group of people there anyway. And I would say that is there on WhatsApp groups, as painful as those groups can be, because people end up on so many. But it is there, and there is an opportunity to come together. And I agree with you, there isn't funding and resources for that, but that's because people in power don't want those things to be happening. Those groups organise outside of the police and outside of community networks, and even some of the asylum seeker support networks, in particular in Knowsley, the ones supported by the church, won't support those groups that are organising in an anti-racist way. And it's really important to be mindful of that and how that happens. But for me, the strength has come from being able to be part of those networks. And I'd really encourage people to be part of those networks, because for me, otherwise, the fear would just take over.
It's going to sound like I'm a defender of everything in the establishment, but one of the things about the protests about Palestine is that it was the police in London who defended the right to protest and actually controlled the rioters when they came out on Armistice Day and things like that. So one of the reasons I think for that isn't because, just because of all these British values and things, but it is actually that the police can't function as the arm of a repressive state without a more repressive society, and actually recognize they're the ones who are actually having to try and control what things against the politicians sometimes. So my issue really is that I can see that there are institutions which are withdrawn from the public sphere. I mean, I'm in the church, and I try to get the church to talk about Palestine and my bishop and things, and they won't, and all the local churches and things like that. But that's because the Church of England is predominantly white and aging. So I think I don't want to look for, you know, demons within our institutions, but I think we should recognise that there are things like simply the dominance of certain groups and the lack of representation of other groups, which create certain conditions which mean that nobody cares about what happens, for example.
I'm just thinking that if we attend churches, then our local churches are our resources that we can turn into social spaces. I mean, we were pretty unenergetic Quaker meeting in South Birmingham. We could only cope with worshipping on a Sunday morning. We didn't use our building weekday evenings, Saturdays and things. And we just had a really powerful member of our community who found community groups that needed somewhere to rent. And we've got asylum seeker groups, we've got Sikh ladies, we've got a whole host of community groups are using our building. And nobody can tell us that we can't, because it's our building and we can welcome people in. And then we've started solving the problem.
Hello there. Thank you, Joshua. We came in a little bit late. One thing you said you said, I didn't say this is going to be a nice talk or something of words along that line. Jolly, that's the word. I feel, everybody's got loads of different points of views, and that sometimes is a problem. I think the society today is so toxic. We don't know a left hand from our right hand. We say innocent before proven guilty. We tend to go with racism, with immigrants, with normal people. We put so much money into the guilt before we look at the innocent. And it's so opposite to the way God sees things. And you talked about the government. You talked about the government, and they appear to be just voicing between the parties themselves and not listening to the people. Nobody wants to see too many people coming to a country in one sense, but in another sense, as you said in your talk, we need doctors, we need people in all different areas, you know, and we need to be looking for those people, not looking to get rid of those people. And I feel that so many people with so much talent and skill are being pushed across the water or back across the water. And it's perhaps not, and I don't feel it's their fault that they got into a boat. You know, I don't think it's their fault that they feel the way they do. But my feeling is it's not the way God sees things. And we're trying to put the narrative the way God sees things, and it's not really what it is.
Amen.
I'll give it to you next. I'm not a Christian. I'm Muslim. I'm also someone that did a lot of feminist organising in women's centres that don't exist anymore, buildings that don't exist anymore. And I just wanted to go back and reiterate what the person who was sitting there said, which is that, like, you need spaces. And what's really struck me, having kind of come into contact with the church, because my partner is a priest, is the church has millions of buildings. You have thousands and thousands of buildings. And, like, all of you could go back to your churches and join the committees that run those churches. The churches, I didn't realise, are run by the congregations, and set the agenda and say, I want an anti-racist group. I want the thing. This is what we want our spaces to be used for, because WhatsApp groups are great, but you need real spaces. And, like, actually the one thing that all of you, if you are going back to your churches, are rich in is a space. So just, if you're going away feeling really despondent because it's a terrible time, you do have a resource and you can use it.
Yeah, unsurprisingly, I was going to say something similar about spaces. The other point is also about institutional power. The Church of England has a huge amount of institutional power. A lot of people at Greenbelt are members of the Church of England. A lot of people here are in positions of power themselves as well. So, and we really shouldn't ignore the fact that, you know, it's good to come here and listen to speakers. It's good to think about what we can do, but we need to take that with us when we go home. We need to use the power that we have as members of the established church whilst establishment is still a thing, which, of course, I don't think it should be. Many of you probably agree with me on that. But whilst it is, you know, we do hold a lot of power, and we can be using it in lots of ways, not only in terms of the buildings we own, but the money we have, the access we have to people in positions of authority. And there's a lot more that we can all be doing.
You literally said some of the things I want to say as we close. I guess I'll just say 100% that, and I'd extend it to, oftentimes your workplace might have spaces you can use, or some of the places where you go for learning, or some of the other social spaces that you use might have those facilities. So your religious establishments, but also anywhere you might find yourself in your community. And I just wanted to say to your point lastly, which I thought was a really important point, which is, like, the people who are at the sharpest end of a lot of these crises are very precarious, very time poor, and often it is dangerous to organize, whether you're a young person or whether you're, you know, an asylum seeker. And one simple thing is, I mean, in the groups that I've been a part of, is that those groups need to be led by those people. And those people are the only people who can say, what is the safest way? Where is this? What? Not the SWP, exactly. Yeah, who, you know, where's the best place? What's the best time of day? What they need to be able to access it. That's, you know, we take the lead and then we work with. That's the only way I can think. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining this talk. And yeah, good luck.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.